Welcome to the latest episode of the Movie Breakdown, and to all our Canadian listeners, happy Thanksgiving. I hope you're having a great time with your family. Maybe you had your turkey yesterday. Maybe you're having it today. Get yourself some pumpkin pie. Enjoy the holiday and now sit down and enjoy the Movie Breakdown. If you're not from Canada, you know, happy Monday. You can have a fun time too. And to celebrate this Monday, we got three movie reviews for you, including the latest horror picture coming from Netflix. This one is an adaptation from a novella that was co-written by Stephen King and his son Joe Hill. It's called In the Tall Grass. And a quick little correction. Last week I said it was Stephen King and Owen King. They did a novel together called Sleeping Beauties. That one I do own and I have read. This one I have not. As well, we are going to have, we are going to remember, in my eyes, I think one of the movie legends, a great, great actor. And that is Robert Forster, who has sadly passed away this week to brain cancer. And so we're going to look back at his career. And then we're going to do a segment that we do every few months. Well, we've only ever done it once, but our goal is to do it every few months. And well, this happens to be the month. And that's the Scott Review Roundup. As Scott's seen a bunch of movies that I've already reviewed, but he hadn't seen them at the time. So now we're going to hear his thoughts. And he's going to tell me how wrong I was when I first reviewed the movies. I'm Christopher Spicer.
And I'm Scott Martin. And I made a mistake last week. I referenced that Robert De Niro took, I believe I said Candace Bergman, out for a date in Taxi Driver. Sybil Shepherd was definitely the correct answer on that one.
You said Candace Bergman?
Yeah.
That's so funny that I didn't correct you, because I clearly heard Sybil Shepherd in my head.
I'm positive I said Candace Bergman, so...
Okay, you may have, but that's bad on me, too, because I knew it was Sybil Shepherd.
Yeah, growing up, I knew them both as blonde people with funny sitcoms.
I don't know if Candace Bergman established herself yet by the time Taxi Driver came?
I don't think so.
Yes, but Sybil Shepherd would have just been breaking up. Anyway, Sybil Shepherd's great in that movie, mm-hmm. And so now she gets her props.
That's right. Finally, she's been waiting all this time, and she finally gets recognition for what she's done. It's a good day. Happy turkey bird, Sybil.
happy turkey bird indeed. And you know, when I think turkey bird, when I think Thanksgiving, I think harvest, you know, like a field.
As do I, and why not? And this movie we're talking about, In the Tall Grass, let's just say it started off with a very much Children of the Corn feel, the opening shot. I'm just like, okay, that's kind of neat. And what I liked about In the Tall Grass is within the first 5 minutes, you're introduced to the peril. You know, there's no real setup here. It's just people start walking and they... You know, the brother and his sister, they pull over to the side of the road. They hear a kid calling out in this a big field of tall grass, calling for help. And they go in, and basically, as soon as they're a few meters into the tall grass, you've already got an understanding of this is, like, haunted, or there's something wrong here. And I love that. I love that, you know, it right away... That's introduced, and the good thing is that as the movie plays out, different aspects of it play out, and we learn different things. So while we get an idea right at the beginning, it does morph, because it could have gotten stale pretty quickly if it was just the same thing of people walking around and not being able to find each other because the damn tall grass just was a jerk. Don't get me wrong, the tall grass is a jerk. That is true. I'm not making that up. It's a complete jerk. What we have here, like I said, a brother and sister. The sister's pregnant. That's Becky DeMuth, played by Laisla de Oliveiro, and her brother Cal DeMuth is played by Avery Waited, and they are separated. She was going to San Diego for some undisclosed reason, but we get an idea that it's a major life decision. There's something big. We almost get this idea that she's, it almost feels like she's running away from something or starting a new life. So there's that we have to connect to her. And then, you know, we come across this young kid, Tobin is in the fields later to grow up and write a spirit guide. But that's the first thing I thought of. I'm like, Tobin's spirit guide.
A point for you.
Thank you. And I'll say this, he's dirty and everything, and he's a creepy looking kid. He just, they cast him real well to have this almost something different about him look. And then we also get Patrick Wilson showing up, and he's been in a few horrors before, and I'm always a fan of Patrick Wilson. And he does well in here. I like a lot of this movie. I love the concept. There's times where some of this stuff feels not cinematic, almost in a way like it's made straight to video. Like you almost get that feel through some of this stuff. So I don't think that the directing by Vincenzo Natali is the sharpest here. I don't necessarily get that. There's a moment I know later in the film where someone's getting fed something and it's supposed to be a gross out horrible scene that's gonna, you know, make you squirm and everything, and I was just irritated by it because of how it was directed, the sound and all that, and just a person just blindly chewing on something, and I don't know, it didn't hit home. So there were these issues for me in this film that it wasn't perfectly, you know, pulled off. And I think that some of the depth that you find in a Stephen King novel or novella, there's usually a lot about the characters that's being revealed or that they're confronting in his works. And I think it's just sort of grazed over a bit here. We get, you know, someone calling the brother on being in love with his sister, but it's not developed. And it's not at all. I mean, that's the downside. So it's like I watch this and I honestly feel like this could have been up there with Hereditary. Like I honestly feel like this concept could have been up there with something like that. But it just too much of it makes it feel like a straight to video movie. I think maybe it's because I love the concept and I like where it goes and I'm a fan for this sort of movie that I'm giving it a 3 stars, because I think it's got value for people who are into that sort of, you know, what's real, time warp. Sorry, that's kind of maybe a spoiler, but don't worry, it won't ruin anything. If you're a fan of those films, I think this is worth checking out, but it's just... The whole time made me think it could have been so much more.
Yeah, and this is directed by Vincenzo Natali, like you said, who made another movie where I feel like the premise was amazing and the beginning was amazing, and then it sort of unravels a little bit when it tries to work with the emotions. And that's another Canadian Canadian film called Cube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that one, I mean, when you think of concept, just amazing. But and it starts off and it starts building, but you're right. I think it tries to have character development, but it fails in some ways.
Yeah. But I mean, if I was going to get someone to do this movie, I think I would go to the director who did Cube, because it's another sort of very tight, you're staying in one kind of location and you're working off people. And I think Cube, if you've never heard of it and you love horror stuff and definitely high concept horror, I do think you should go see Cube. Mm-hmm. I think most of people I know about Cube, but I mean, it's 97, so there's a good chance that maybe some of our younger listeners has never heard of the movie. This one, it's really interesting because I have not read this novella, as I revealed last week. I've read a lot of Stephen King stuff, though. And while watching this, there's a lot where I could tell, like, okay, I can see the Stephen King in this. Mm-hmm. I can see the aspects of the novella, but because I haven't read the novella, I don't know if some of the issues I have with this story comes from the novella itself or how it decided to be adapted. But I saw certain things at the beginning, the opening, that felt so Stephen King. Mm. The concept of them being stuck in the grass, but there being kind of a supernatural element, very, very Stephen King. And then even when the issues start happening and people start having conflict and we learn about their past and there's issues between the brother and the sister and then the deadbeat boyfriend and all these different things, those moments felt like that. I was like, this definitely was in the novella. I could tell because this is a very Stephen King thing. But with Stephen King, I think it would have slow built better and it would have felt more natural. And here it just felt like, oh yeah, I got to put this in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it did. It felt like adding ingredients almost.
And so I feel like the Stephen King ingredients were here, but it just felt very jarring here and not smooth. I love the first half of this movie. I was all in, and that is definitely where my recommendation was going to be coming. And then I just felt the second half started falling apart a bit. I thought the character stuff wasn't developed super well. It goes in some weird, bizarre areas, which I'm totally fine with, but I didn't think the mythology, let's say, and the things behind this, I didn't think it did a good job of necessarily making it clear that, like, one person acts a certain way because of something, but then another person didn't seem to get affected the same way. I thought the creepy child, the way he behaved, changed throughout the movie. Like, there's just little character moments that really threw me off. And so it was harder to get in. I just thought there wasn't the tightest of narrative here and the tightest of character motivation. I just didn't understand some of the motivation there and some of the choices there. And like you, I thought some of the directing at times, something that should have been scary and creepy, I thought weren't totally pulled off. Like you, though, I really liked the concept and I thought the performances were really good. So I was in it all the way through. So I would say I liked it for the most part, and I would tell horror fans to see it. I can't do the full-on recommendation, though, because I thought those issues were big enough. So I'm going 2.5.
And could I dare fault you? Because it
because like you, I did enjoy it for the most part. It just comes down to you're sort of doing like your whole, like you like to say, lame duck 3, I think, and I'm just doing the more strong 2.5.
Yeah, it's definitely in that area, and it's, like I said, recommended for people who are into that type of film, because I think there's something in there that's going to interest you. But this isn't one of those horrors that I think is a gateway or a good entry point for other people, because it's just not crafted well enough. And I really, I would be shocked if I read the novella and found that there was the same lack of development of the characters.
Me too. I feel like this was just an issue of not quite smoothly putting everything in.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of directors miss in Stephen King adaptations, I believe, is Stephen King is all about what are the characters going through and how is what they're facing, how is that changing them, or what do they have to do to confront it. That's all it's about. And a lot of the movies, they think that it's just about the scary thing. And so, I mean, this is a very common failing for Stephen King adaptations.
And any director who's going to adapt a Stephen King work should listen to his interviews, because he said many times, as a writer, he is more interested in the humans and the characters and how they respond to adversity than he is in the monster. To him, the storytelling is more fascinating with responses and how it challenges you than the creature. And like you said, I think a lot of times the movie does the reverse.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he says that, but he also, I mean, if you read it, you know that that's truth. You know that the characters are what he really focuses on. And that's why I've loved reading his stuff and what elevates it over other things, as far as I was concerned, especially as a teenager searching for different horror authors. I landed on Stephen King because I got so absorbed, and you start wondering, you know, oh, how would I react the same way? And what if I was going through those things? And it's, you start wondering, you know, how would you react as a character instead of how would I react against the monster?
No, exactly. 100%. I mean, my favorite Stephen King stuff, Salem's Lot, I could be going forever, but a lot of them, my attachment to them is the character response. Salem's Lot is about vampire. Well, the vampire is it's a town being taken over by a vampire and people turning into vampires. But the fascinating thing about it isn't the vampires, it's the town. It's seeing the day-to-day life. The first like 100 pages is just about all the issues that are in that town before the vampire comes and how people interact, and you get to learn about this whole town of Salem. And then when the vampires come, you're hooked and you care about these characters. And it's more about how does this world work now with these vampires in here? It's not like, oh, it's fascinating because of the kills. I mean, that's there. What's fascinating about it is the people in this town.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's why I really like getting into his stuff, because that's what he focuses on. And I think the movie could have focused that on that more. And I think it would have been much more intriguing. I just need to say, earlier, it sounded like I was slamming Cube. Cube's a movie I recommend, and actually is one of those ones where I would actively tell people, this is, if you're a horror fan, this is like must see viewing. It has some of the same failings as this.
No, it does. It 100% does. That's why when I saw this, I was not shocked at all. It was the same director. There's a lot about Cube I love. I just feel like with Cube, the ending part, how some characters respond and a certain character who becomes a villain, it just gets there too quick. It gets too ramped up and it doesn't have that slow build. And that's the same issue I had with this movie, where I just felt like certain characters' responses kind of came out of nowhere, and it was just like, oh, now we got to get into the end game. And the last part kind of falls apart for me here. And I said some stuff doesn't necessarily make sense. And there's some things here that I have some issues with, sort of the mythology, whatever. But let's be honest, if all that mythology was still there, and the timeline stuff and all the stuff that I think is a little screwy, if that was all still there, but the characters felt more fleshed out, I would be recommending this movie. That is the bigger issue.
Mm-hmm. And we did get a Kona Crush moment here in this film. We've been waiting for that forever, for that finisher.
Oh, that's right, we did. I didn't know what you're talking about, but once you said that, I got you. Yeah, no, and now we know why it's so effective and why he won so many matches.
Yeah, because it wasn't lame at all at the time.
Oh, but then he moved to a much cooler finisher, the heart punch.
Oh, yes, yes. That was just wonderful stuff.
I find it really, really funny that somehow you brought in wrestling, because before we started the podcast, we were actually talking about one day doing a wrestling podcast. I feel like you're almost like trying to tease our listeners. So this is a taste of, if that ever happens, what you're going to get.
That's right.
Kona Crush talk.
Kona Crush references. That's right. And you know you want it. You know you want it.
Oh, we all want it.
Mm-hmm.
Scott's recommending this. I'm not quite 2.5, but I can see a lot what he sees. And we love horror. Another genre that we both really love is a coming of age story. And we got that this week too in Tall Girl. And this is a story about a teenager who, wait for it, is tall.
What? Shut the front door.
I know. I was shocked too. The tall girl is played by Ava Michelle, who in the film is Jodie Kramer, and she's a girl who basically she stands out. She's super, super tall, and she doesn't feel like she fits in the high school world. She's a 60-year-old girl who's 6'2". People say stuff like, how's the weather up there? And they mock her a lot. I had a little bit, like, I'm not saying that tall people don't get teased in high school, but I did have a little disconnect in this film in that she's a pretty girl, and she's 6'2", which is very tall, but they made it sound like she towers over everybody. And I mean, when I went to high school and I went into a smaller city, there was definitely people that are over 6'2" guys that went to my high school. There were some taller girls too. They may have not been 6'2". And I didn't feel, like there'd be this world where she would be taller than everyone or that she would get mocked that much. Maybe that's my own foolishness. So there was a little bit of disconnect there just because she was pretty and she was confident. I felt like she would have fit in better than the movie sort of tries to make you take. But the movie's point is that we all have these things that can overcome us. We all have these things that we can be afraid of. We have all these things that can give us these social hang-ups. Everyone at certain times feels like a loser, and it's even harder in high school where you're self-conscious and day to day you have to see that, look in the mirror and say, oh, I'm not good enough. And this film's about this, like owning what you have and making it into something great and believing in yourself. And so even though maybe I had a little bit of a hang up in the end, I understood what it was trying to tell. And so I rolled with that story, especially since I thought Ava Michelle was a really great in the lead role here. And so I enjoyed her in that spot. And I enjoyed her friendships. She has two friends. She has one friend who is really kind of confident in herself, one that doesn't necessarily have any social hang-ups, though I guess her parents are really annoyed because her friend convinced her not to go in the track of being a doctor, but instead being a fashion person, and she likes to dance. And then she has a really a best friend of a boy who's really stuck on her. That's kind of like her ducky. I felt like this was almost like a modern version of Pretty in Pink. That kind of gives you the idea. The one girl feels like an outcast, and then she likes the hot popular boy trying to fit in, and then she has sort of the best friend who's harboring a crush for her. The difference within Pretty in Pink, Ducky keeps his love secret, while her best friend here makes it clear right from the beginning that he loves her and is always trying to ask her out, to a point where I thought it was kind of creepy, and sometimes it comes off a little bit stalkerish. I think the movie thought we were supposed to see it as cute, but at times I just thought his affection for her bordered on a little bit creepy and questionable, and I didn't really understand why Jody would stick with a guy who was so obsessed with her all the time. We've also, of course, got the popular girl who is mean to Jody, and she's sort of our villain. That's Kimmy Stitcher, played by Clara Wisely, and she mocks her. And again, there's a few things here where even like her in crowd who mocks Jody, sometimes that was a little bit over the top. And there are certain things where I didn't understand where one person who was particularly mean to her, it just changed really quickly. And all of a sudden now he has like a crush on her, and and how quickly they kind of accepted people. There's things here that I just sometimes I thought were, they went too over the top in one area. So it made it harder for me to buy where it went in the next direction of the film. But I got to move to the main plot. And what happens is we've got a foreign exchange student, and he's played by Luke Eisner, and he comes in and he's hot. So back in Sweden, he was a loser, and now he has the opportunity to be super cool because everyone in Sweden is super good looking, and he's apparently the ugly version, but he's super hot when he comes to America. Instantly, of course, the cool girl wants to be with him, but Jody's got a crush on him as well, and he kind of likes Jody, but he's kind of torn with the idea of also wanting to be popular. And so that's what we have the dynamic here. We've got the best friend boy who's always liked Jody, and then this new guy wants to be friends with him, but also is moving in on Jody, so he gets jealous. So we've got ourselves more than a love triangle. We've got a love square, because we've got the popular girl in there too. And so all that conflict and drama. I thought this movie, it's hard, it's in the right place. It's got a good message. I enjoy sort of the soundtrack, the type of movie it was. I thought it was really well directed for the type of movie it was. I thought it did a good job of being patient with its shots, the dance sequences, and all the sort of stuff at school. I thought a good job of kind of immersing you in there. I thought that stuff all works. There's a nice, good sense of humor, especially coming from her two parents, Angela Kinsey, who people would know as Angela in The Office, And then Steve Zane, who a lot of people already know, or Steve Zahn, sorry. Steve Zahn, that a lot of people already know, is a very funny man, and I thought he was really funny here as the father. I've never seen him in the father role, and I thought he did it really well, balancing his usual kind of wacky humor with being a sincere, caring dad. So I thought all that stuff works really well. Like I said, I thought this was trying to be a bit of a comedy, and I thought that stuff worked well. There were just certain elements that I couldn't connect with some of the character motivations, and some stuff was overblown. So while I really enjoyed a lot of it, I think when you compare it to Eighth Grade, you compare it to like Edge of 17 and some of these other coming of age stories, it's not quite there. So once again, I'm going to go 2.5.
You're speaking my language. I think I like the basic structure of this, and there's,
yeah, it's really good.
There's some tightness to it. Like, we're a lot of what I criticized in The Tall Grass about isn't here. Like, it feels much more crafted. However, the elements, the base elements, feel like they're way off. Like, this girl, yeah, she's tall, and maybe 6'2" is tall for a 16-year-old woman.
It is.
But I mean, when you're in high school, 6'2" isn't a full foot above everyone else.
Was it in my high school?
No. So, like, I mean, I understand that, you know, they're looking for a different way of, say, you know, other people, you know, may have issues about their appearance and their self-confidence. I really felt like this was not in any kind of reality. Remember when I texted you about Reality High earlier in this week?
Yes.
Yeah, this was what I was watching, because it wasn't realistic that everyone is that much shorter than her and that she stands out that much. When I was in high school, there were a few really taller girls, and they were really well known, because, and I'm not saying that our main character needed to be athletic, but they were, you know, playing volleyball, playing basketball, so they had tons of friends.
That's what I'm saying. If she was in basketball, she would be ostracized. She would have been popular. And based off what I've seen in this movie, I think the actual actress is athletic.
She looks athletic, doesn't she? Like, she's, yes, got a very trim, athletic build to her.
And at the end sequence, they have an end credit where she sees them dancing. She's got moves. She wasn't awkward in her movement. Like, she seemed very put together and very fine in her body. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you're agreeing with me, because I thought it was nitpicky, but it was just hard for me to connect because of that.
Well, that's the thing. It's as hard to understand that as it is to understand that Stieg is an ugly Swedish kid.
Yes.
And I have to comment on her lovable friend that has a crush on her. You nailed some of this stuff. Also, I think it goes even a bit further to an entitlement that... he has an entitlement to her because he's had a crush on her longer. So if someone has a crush on her, too bad, guy. I was here first, therefore I'm entitled to the girl. It was an early bird gets the worm thing, and I was super not comfortable with that, because...
well, that's a dangerous mindset, especially how this movie unfolds. That's a dangerous mindset for a teenage boy to see.
Yes, because the woman does have a chance. Just because you liked her for, you know, 5 years doesn't mean that that you are entitled to the prize. So I really, really didn't like that. I think that they thought that Dunkelman character was much different than he was.
I didn't think that he was charming and funny. Well, I actually thought he was scary, and I was rooting against him.
I thought he was completely inappropriate. Scary is a good word. This movie had other aspects of teen life that completely were unrealistic. Like, when Stieg sits at the popular table and invites Dunkelman over and, you know, do your Gordon Ramsay impersonation. And all of a sudden he is a popular kid. He's, you know, like, I've been through high school, and I'm sure most of our listeners have, and that's not how it works. That is, I mean, he should have just, like, called on Thor's hammer and smashed the ground and killed everyone, because that's as realistic as what happened in that scene.
Yeah, I that's sort of what I was alluding to in my review was, I mean, she got mercifully made fun of certain people, and then as the movie progresses, they're kind of hanging out, and there was character interaction, motivation. I was like, that even in a movie, it's kind of really asked me to go really far in my disbelief.
Yeah.
Suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm there with you, but I like the lead. I love her parents. I
thought
like...
even though I didn't like her best friend, I thought Griffin Gluck, the actor, played it really well.
Yes, I thought she was very charming. I want to see her in other roles. It's just unfortunate that her character felt like a huge walking trope. And I really liked seeing Steve Zahn and Angela Kinsey here together. I thought they were great. And I loved the fact that there's this little joke about her sister being so attractive and all that, but have, you know, this, she has the allergy, so she's always sneezing. I like that. That was fun.
Yeah, no, it was good. One other main issue with this one, I think, and I think it's also what hurt maybe some of the believability of stuff, I just thought it was trying to juggle too many characters and had too many sort of subplots, because there was several little subplots it threw in, maybe because it felt like this is what you need in these kind of movies, that I felt did not have a satisfying conclusion. Even the issue with Jodie, what she, you know, she's got to have an issue at some point with her best female friend. It happens. I thought that was just almost needless. Mm-hmm. So there's a subplot going on with the mom and the older sister that really went nowhere. Like, they're just, I thought there was a little too many characters it tried to juggle.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. It should have been more streamlined, and it's just lucky it had likable people cast, and it was fairly tight, except for its flaws, which really it's hard to get behind a coming of age story when the issue really doesn't seem realistic. Like, I'm not saying that, you know, tall girls that their struggles aren't realistic. It's just the universe itself that was in seemed unrealistic. The struggles themselves, I'm not saying don't happen or aren't justified. It just, it wasn't portrayed well.
It probably also doesn't help that 2 weeks ago we saw five good movies, then four really good coming-of-age movies.
That's right. Because nobody came of age in Murder Party.
No, but I'm just thinking, like, Easy A and all those. Mm-hmm. They're just a step above, yeah. And so they're probably fresh in my mind. Who knows if I saw this at another time, if I'd recommend it. Because, like I said, I largely liked it. Mm-hmm. I came out of it being like, I can't really recommend this because it just didn't handle things tight. Like, a movie I recommend, especially with coming-of-age, it just would have handled a few of these things a bit better.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now it's time for a documentary. And this one is called Hello Privilege. It's me, Chelsea. And it is by Chelsea Handler, who is a comedian that I know very little about other than she's got a Netflix show. And this is basically a white person who was very, very successful in the comedy world, taking a look at what it means to be white and what white privilege is, and how that sort of shaped her life and how that affected her career, because she admits this is something that she never thought about, that that she just never looked at the idea of white privilege, because I think the point is, if you're white, you don't understand that you're privileged. You don't understand that it even exists. A lot of white people think that white privilege doesn't exist. I would tend to seriously disagree with that. I like in here that she faces some hard stuff. And she faces criticisms. People in this documentary really criticize her. And so I've got some respect here for Chelsea Handler for putting herself in these very vulnerable situations where she's saying, look, I want to learn. And then having, you know, African-American people, you know, some of them saying, well, you know, this or this, and other people saying, well, you know, I don't like this. I don't like you because you're coming in here with, you know, wanting us to explain to you, you know, your issue. And there were some people who had really, like, legitimate, I couldn't disagree with what some people were saying about it. So I much respect for Chelsea Handler for putting herself in these situations, being very vulnerable. I mean, that is super vulnerability there, but then a lot more respect because she didn't edit that stuff out. She didn't make this documentary seem as though, you know, she's flying around, you know, waving a magic wand to fix everything. So I like that aspect of it. I think that this is a very important issue. I'm not going to say that this is as good as 13th or, you know, many documentaries that have looked at race, especially in America. But this is something that I think a lot of white people need to see, because a lot of white people in this day and age are getting to the point where it seems like they're saying, get over it. It's over. Racism's dead. You know, slavery's dead, but racism isn't. And this brings me to a bit of a really, really sticking point with me. I don't like the fact that white people think that they're entitled to dictate what's racist and not. It's like if a woman walks down the street and a guy catcalls at her and then says, look, man, look, lady, take it as a compliment. It's not the oppressor's role to say that what they're doing is right or justified. It's like when the Myanmar army, you know, cleared itself of all alleged abuses against the Rohingya Muslims, you know, they basically wrote their own report card and said, no, we didn't do anything wrong. It's not those people. They can't say whether they did or didn't. It's the oppressed. It's the people that are being put down. If they're saying it happens, it's happening. And so I really, really am getting frustrated with this white person mentality of, oh, it's not racist. You're not the one to say that. You can't say that. It's not your place. And so I like this because I think it starts exploring some of that. So my rant over. I do think that there, you know, are some flow issues with this. I think, you know, there's one scene where she spends some times with an ex-boyfriend, and that goes on longer, I think, than it needed to be. I think it would have been better served, this documentary, if it trimmed that down, spoke to a few different people. I think this could have been a lot more impactful in that way, because I think there were some really, really neat settings. I wish there were people that, you know, they showed more of, because it felt like, you know, well, you set these people up for an interview, you got them in there, you know, you're only a minute or an hour and 4 minutes. Go back to them.
I know.
Right? Like, go back to them, get more from them, because, you know, the interview's probably at least half an hour to an hour. So show us more than 35, 40 seconds. So structurally, like I said, there's some issues here, but I really think that this is something that white people need to see. Because white people don't get it. I think the thing here is, like, you know, should you get it? How can you get it? And it really seems like a hard thing to put your hand on, but I think a lot of white people need to understand that maybe there is something here, and that just brushing it off and saying that it doesn't exist, or saying that, you know, Or being the ones that dictate, oh, no, that's not racist or whatever. That, you know what, maybe you should look at this, because dictating what is or isn't racist, that's white privilege as well. Getting that opportunity to say, you know, the police show up. Hi, I heard there were screams. Did you beat your wife? Playfully. It's okay. Playfully. No, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. So, and it's the same thing with racism. So I give this 3 stars. I really think that this could have been more probing. I did like Chelsea Handler in here. I didn't really know much of her before. She's so sincere in here. She doesn't mind showing her blind spots, her failings. I really appreciate that, because I think a lot of, like, when we did the Quincy Jones documentary, it felt like there was brushing over the more serious issues. And we talked about that, about how it really didn't pay service to the deeper things. Whereas with this, Chelsea Handler seems fine with showing anything and everything. So I appreciate that. I give it 3 stars. Just, it could have been better, but it's still definitely worth seeing.
Yeah, you're 100% right. This definitely could have been better. And I was really confused that it's only an hour and 10. I felt like there could have been so much more. But at the same time, the reason why I wanted so much more was I was really engaged with what I got. The hour and 10 minutes I thought was really good. Like you, I don't know a lot about Chelsea Handler. I've heard her name a lot. She gets mentioned on articles. People tweet about her a lot, so I know she's a big name. I just haven't really seen a lot of her stuff. A lot of the stuff I read about her were in the negative. Like, I've always, there seems to be people who really push against her. And I have to say, while watching, I didn't see it. I enjoyed her. I thought she was funny. I thought she was charming. I thought she was, like you said, very sincere. And I thought she was very confident and not scared to make herself look bad, not scared. Like, I thought she was very brave, putting herself in tough spots. And I appreciate that. Like, she clearly was not trying to, you know, protect her brand. Like, she was willing to have people call her out and dress her down. And she put that in the movie. And I really came out of it feeling like she really wanted to find the answer. She really wanted to understand white privilege, understand how she got there, and understand sort of where society is, where that mindset is. I just think it came from a genuine place, and I came out of it really respecting her. And it, and like any good documentary, it got me thinking and challenging myself on it and wondering really ideas of white privilege and do I sometimes think in different ways. So it did everything it was supposed to do. Like you, I think it could have been maybe a bit more focused. I think I would have liked other interviews a bit more, but I'm definitely going 3 stars because I think people should see it. And I also really like that it didn't necessarily come out of the movie did not come away looking like it had an agenda. Mm-hmm. It really looked like it was just trying to find answers and discover. Because even when she talked to those Republican women and when she talked to people on the right, I did not feel like the movie was trying to attack them or make them look negative. They felt like sincere interviews. The one interview with the Republican woman was awesome because near the end, she started challenging herself. So it felt more like a conversation mm-hmm. rather than like that one movie a few weeks ago we talked about where it's like it had an agenda.
Yeah, yeah. And this one, yeah, it does feel like it feels like someone trying to pop the bottle, pop the top and get into something. Because like you said with the Republican woman, it would have been very easy for them to overlay some kind of music or edit it differently. They let them have their say. It didn't feel like these women were edited out away from what they were saying, and they were allowed to. They were allowed to have that opinion.
And this may annoy some people. Maybe it'll even annoy you. I think some of them had valid points.
I think some were on the wrong path, but I mean,
yeah.
The nice thing about this is you hear.
I'm not saying I agree mm-hmm. with everything. I just saying that I felt like the movie allowed them to at least say their side, and some of the stuff was like, okay, I could see where you're coming.
You're coming from, and that's what I liked, and that's why I liked the way it wasn't edited out, because it's like you could see. Oh, maybe if I had your upbringing, if I had, you know, that same thing, there's a chance I could feel the same way. So I liked that because, like you said, it's more of a discussion, and it lets everyone have their say, sort of.
And I really enjoyed her going to Oktoberfest because you got some interesting things here. Yeah, the one guy who apparently thinks voting is a privilege, so
yes.
he clearly doesn't understand what democracy is. So that was very eye-opening. It was like, okay, that shows. But I also really loved the one person who gave a very sincere response, and I wish I would give that response, but I probably wouldn't because I'm too wordy, who essentially said, as a white person, who am I to decide what white privilege is?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, or something, phrasing something like the idea that, yeah. of like, that I don't have the right to say that. And I was like, he's right.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And
this is kind of like what you were saying earlier. Like, we don't, me as a white guy, I don't get to dictate what racism is or even what white privilege is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I'm in it.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's why I loved how this was edited and put together, because it's not constructed to, and it doesn't even answer the question necessarily.
It doesn't, but it starts a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely think, like I said, I think it's really worth viewing. I just wish it was broadened out a bit better.
One thing that may frustrate people is what you just said. The movie ends, it doesn't really give you an answer. It doesn't tell you how to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tell you really how we get rid of white privilege and move forward. But I think it's also because as a society, as a group, as a community, we don't know that. The only thing I really got out of this is we can work on our empathy. We can work on our listening. We can work on our open-mindedness. And those are the type of things that eventually we might find a resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you give your rating?
Yeah, I give it 3 stars. Mm-hmm. I definitely recommend it. I thought I had said that earlier.
You probably did.
People definitely should listen to it. I don't know if this is a perfect, this is probably a really bad analogy you could call on me, but I think one of the things just to sort of, to me, understanding this notion of white privilege, definitely racism, and how people can't dictate it, is this idea of, for example, let's say I have a friend who's really down out and he hasn't found a job or whatever, and every single day I go to his house and I tell him, you just stay at home, makes you a loser, you need to get out there and do something. And I scream at him and say, you need to motivate yourself, you are doing nothing with your life, and then I leave. And I do it for 2 weeks, and then that person finally tells me, you know, you're making me feel worse, mm-hmm. and you're making me feel less of a person, this isn't working, and me saying, no, I'm encouraging you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because again, it's not that, like, it's this idea where even if you're meaning good, if the person's telling you your attempt to make things better is actually making it worse, you have to listen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You have to understand that you're not the one with the final say. The person who is being affected by it, if they're saying this is negative, you can't say no, it's positive. Well, no, it's actually bringing them down, making it worse.
And even if you disagree with them, the whole point is, and I think this is the white privilege, that even if you disagree with them, empathy and listening, maybe you could both work it out and figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely, like I said, definitely something that I think a lot of people should see. And it's not long, so it's not hard to see.
No, you could probably get that and then watch In the Tall Grass right after.
Mm-hmm. And this was not starring Candace Bergman.
No, so far she has not starred in any of the movies we reviewed. And we're not reviewing any more movies now. Well, we kind of are, but we'll wait for that. Now what we're going to do is we are going to talk about Robert Forster, who has just passed away. I believe it was on Friday it was announced. He passed away from brain cancer at the age of 78. And I know there's a lot of people that would probably disagree with me on this. I mean, most people probably see Robert Forster. Like, I confess on this show, we have not talked about every major star who's passed away. And we have definitely not talked about a lot of really talented character actors and supporting actors through their career. And so some people will wonder, well, why did you pick Robert Forster? Because in my mind, the man is a legend. And maybe the box office doesn't show that. And I think there's some people that probably don't see him as a big star. But for me, I just thought he embodied just a grace and just this great warmth and even a sense of power on the big screen. And I thought he was one of the great actors. And so I felt that he was worth talking about, even if he hasn't maybe endured along the lines of some of the other legendary actors. He originally, his breakout movie was Reflections in a Golden Eye, which he had a supporting role in, and that starred with Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor, so that was a great start for him, getting a breakout with two massive big names. And then he got his first big kind of award nomination look, starring in Medium Cool, where he played an ethnic character, one who was coming to terms with the Vietnam War and his place in the world and things like that. And it was a big hit in 1969 and sort of allowed Robert Forster to kind of get on the map. After that, he got a starring role in an NBC TV series. It didn't last very long, Bannon, but from what I've heard, it's one that got some critical acclaim at the time. And then after that, he had His next kind of big film would have been Black Hole, which as a kid I thought was a cool movie. I don't know how well it ages. It ended up being a big box office flop. It was Disney's attempt to be Star Wars back when Disney was not the powerhouse. And so that kind of led to him not sort of, his star kind of fell after that, unfortunately. And then he did a lot of kind of B movies, smaller movies. The thing is, I read some things and people were talking about his down period and talk about and try to lump in the movie Alligator. But to me, Alligator, it's the one where I think at the time it wasn't a major hit, but it's aged really well because it came out during the time when there was all these animal attack movies and he had the Jaws and he had all these different ones. And John Sayles, who's a great screenwriter, great director, he was trying to play with the tropes of that. And I think Alligator, now time has shown that it was a pretty smart movie that was playing around with the tropes and a fun little creature feature movie. And I think Robert Forster is the type of guy that fits with that. He's someone I think adds a little bit of weight and a little bit of critical acclaim, a little bit of panache to a film that he comes into. So I think he was a great addition to something like Alligator. And then he did a lot of B movies throughout the 1980s. He also played an evil foreigner. I think he was supposed to be Iranian in a Cannon film, one of the Chuck Norris's vehicles, where he played a bad guy there. And basically, so his star sort of fell, but Quentin Tarantino is a guy who, if you were someone he looked up to as a kid, he's going to try to find a role for you in the movies. And I think Quentin Tarantino proved to be one of the guys that was great at resuscitating careers, and he did that with Robert Forster. And this is where, to me, he definitely deserves to be under the label of a legend, as he came in as Max Cherry in Jackie Brown, which Jackie Brown is one of my all-time favorite movies. I think it's absolutely incredible. And part of the thing that makes that movie work is Robert Forster here as the sort of down on his luck guy who helps Jackie Brown. They have a nice romance that coming through. And I think he just does a great job there of feeling someone who's humble and someone who is accessible and you could connect to, but at the same time, he has a force. He feels like a powerhouse. He really drives that film. And it was a huge career renaissance for Robert Forster, I think, because it's led to him then getting some more work. He got to be in the Psycho remake. He was hired by David Lynch for Mulholland Drive. He was in the Jim Carrey, Me, Myself, and Irene. And so he got a lot of different supporting roles. A few years ago, he was in Olympus Has Fallen, a movie that I don't necessarily like, but I think actually his role is really great. I think he adds a lot to the credibility of that movie. And I think Robert Forster was that type of guy where if he's in a movie, you know his role is going to be really solid and he's going to add a lot to it. He plays a great kind of grizzled detective or someone who, you know, a military man, but there's a softness to him and something that you connect to. He seemed like he was a great man from everything I read. I know he was a great actor. And like I said, I don't care if you disagree with me. He's a legend in my books, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah, you know, I think we have to speak about him because one of the first, like one of the building blocks of this podcast was Jackie Brown.
Well, that's why I felt like he has to be talked about.
Yeah, it's. I mean, this is like the foundation of what we started as, and he was a major part. Not only did he have a major role, but he had a wonderful performance. And maybe Tarantino fans would hate me for this, but I think this is not just his best film, but by like far and away his best film. And it was made wonderful by the casting, and if you look down the cast list, it's absolutely phenomenal. And Robert Forster in this was really, really key. You mentioned, like, when I was a kid, honestly, Black Hole, if you told me as a kid this is not accepted by humanity and is going to fail, I would have thought you were crazy. I had black.
So would I.
I had black hole wallpaper in my bedroom. I thought it was the greatest thing ever. It was amazing. Alligator. I had known Alligator 2, the mutation. I started getting into B movies, and then when I saw when finally got a chance to see the original Alligator, I'm like, wow, this is actually different than I thought it was going to be. And
yeah, it's actually good.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you mentioned some of his later performances. I have to say it wasn't as good, and I don't want to remember him this way, as Bud Baxter in Last Man Standing. It just wasn't utilizing him properly, and it wasn't necessarily good. I'll admit I laughed at the first season of Last Man Standing. I'll admit. It was funny. And then it decided to have a point every episode. But Robert Forster, he did add something to it. Ty Sheridan was in that a bit as well. So he did try to elevate, I think, something. We're going to be seeing him in El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie. He's going to be in there. Unfortunately, I think that's going to be the last thing we're going to see him in. If you don't know who he is, but if you watch television or watch movies, you've seen him in something. This guy on
he's a different that guy.
Yeah, yeah. He's if you look down, I thought I'd scroll down. I'll just scroll quickly down the IMDb list the other day. I'm like, see, you know, try to refresh myself. Holy crap. Holy crap. You can't just skim through the roles he's had. It's insane. So you've seen him. You've seen him. You just may not know it. He was really good. I liked him, and I think it's incredibly sad because I thought he was good at what he did, and unfortunately wasn't as well renowned as some other people.
Yeah, and that's why I think some people challenge on the legend thing, but I just feel like you watch Jackie Brown, and I mean John Singleton is known essentially for one movie, and most people would challenge the idea that he was a great director. I think you watch Jackie Brown, and that's enough to make it clear that he was this amazing actor. He really helps that movie. But then, like I said, there's movies that he did in the 70s that he got acclaim for. I haven't seen all of them. And Medium Coolness, something I want to track down. And so there's a lot of films from his canon that show his skill that I think people should explore. And I just want to say, because I couldn't remember the name of it, the movie where the canon film where he's the bad guy, Abdul.
Delta Force.
The Delta Force.
Yeah, Delta Force, because those were awesome movies, all the Delta Force films.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a pure Chuck Norris, pure canon, mm-hmm. got a white guy to be the evil Iranian guy. That seems like the 80s.
Yep. So I would have seen him in that, because I do believe I've seen up to Delta Force 4. Was there 4 of them?
There might be. I definitely saw Delta Force. Yeah. Surprisingly enough, it hasn't stuck with me.
Isn't that odd? Isn't that odd how it hasn't stuck?
I mean, I can tell you every scene that happened in Commando. So those are totally the type of movies I remember. But apparently Chuck Norris movies just don't stick.
They're not as good as Liam Neeson's movies.
No, and also, for some reason, I said Medium Coolness. I meant Medium Cool.
Okay, and I apparently said Candace Bergman earlier. I meant Candace Bergen. I'm having an awful time with that poor woman.
If anything, we make mistakes on this show.
We do. Now it's time for you to tell me if I've made some huge mistakes. All right?
I'm ready.
All right, we're going to go through some movies that I have seen that Chris had already reviewed on the podcast. Now, there's going to be a few that I'm going to go over briefly because you may not have heard it, but Chris and I have already talked about it on the Lost Mid-Year show. Some of these movies were discussed, and they just didn't get out.
That's so sad.
It is. So I'm going to mention some of them, but sort of a bit more quickly. And it's hard to remember other films because we may have texted about it. We may have talked before or after the podcast about it, or may have been quickly referenced on the podcast. So I think some of them have been talked about, but not to what extent. So we're just going to go through with this. Starting off with the three that were talked about that I'm sure we talked about earlier, The Kid Who Would Be King. It is a child adventure film that I thought was absolutely perfect. This would have been something I would have just dived right into. Joe Cornish is able, I mean, he took sci-fi and melded it with coming of age. Now he takes absolute fantasy, and I mean, this is absolute fantasy. There is magic and all this stuff, and it is a wonderful ride. It's got some wonderful comedy. I gave that one 4 stars.
Yeah, and I think I said it in the original review. I definitely said it in the lost episode. If you want to talk about a film that would connect to you as a child, I know I would have been really into it as a child, but Everett, I took Everett to see this, and months later, and up until when we were doing the mid-year show, he was still trying to do some of the magic that Merlin did, still trying to learn how to double iron or whatever it was, double his spoons. And so he was really into it. He was immersed into it. I really think it's sad this didn't do as great in the box office. So if you have a kid that has an active imagination, loves adventure, this is a perfect movie. The only thing is, if they're easily scared, there is a few scary elements.
Yeah, there are. So maybe, like, I mean, I wouldn't say like a 3 or 4 year old, but a kid who can get talked through things probably would help.
Yeah, I wouldn't show it to Danica yet. Everett would have been, he would have just been freshly turned 7 when he saw it. So, and it worked for him, though he has a cousin who's a little bit older than him that probably wouldn't have worked for it. So it's, you know, your kids, you know what they're into. But yeah, no, it's a great fantasy adventure. It was a lot of fun. I think I gave it, what did I give it? 3, 3.5?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah.
Now, but yeah, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Now, a movie that we disagreed on, Fighting With My Family. This was the movie about Paige, the very true-to-life movie about Paige, the WWE superstar. And I liked it. I actually, I gave it 3 stars. I thought that the comedy was good, but above all, I loved the casting, and I thought everyone was wonderful in here. This movie really does hit some beats in almost sickly ways at times, but to me, it was the Nick Frost and Lena Headey connection as the parents, and of course, the ever wonderful that Florence Pugh, who I'm just, I mean, this young woman, I'm going to watch anything she's in because she's proving she's just amazing.
Yeah, Florence Pugh is amazing. Florence Pugh is going to be a star. She's getting a lot of work now, and she deserves it. She's been good in everything that I've seen. I thought she was amazing in this movie. I love the casting. I love the humor. I love the charm. And that's what elevated the movie for me, because my biggest issue was it was just a checkbox movie. Like, it hit every beat you needed in a biopic. And so that got annoying. And the part that really annoyed me is when I did some reading after and learned about her actual life, there was no reason to make this movie generic because none of those things actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Which was odd because when there were times where I'm like, this would have been on TV. I'm like, I wonder if they realize that people can research this and find out if it actually happened like this.
Oh yeah, that final scene, go on YouTube and you will see that it happened nothing like that.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. It's a totally fabricated, other than she does have the title match.
Mm-hmm. So like and because WWE was associated, I'm like, I bet you they're going to change it to for a, I don't know. Anyways, I gave it 3. Next film is one that
I gave 2.5. So mm-hmm. It's not like I destroyed it.
No. When Get Out came out, I was hotter on it than Chris was initially. But I mean, multiple views changed. We both increased our appreciation for that film after multiple views, and Chris was hotter on it than I, but I'm sure that because I get the sense that just like Get Out, this one's going to get better on multiple views because that seems to be the way that writer director Jordan Peele makes it. He makes something that you can watch again and pick out more of. This I thought was just if people said that try to argue that Get Out wasn't a proper horror, there's no way you could say the same thing about Us. This one is completely horror. And I love the performance. I love the concept. I like the issue about identity and stuff like that. And I really want to watch it again. This one I gave 3.5 to.
Yeah, and I gave it 4. And I believe it did not make your top 5 movies of the year so far. It made my number 1.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. Now, Lego Movie 2. This one was on its way to be a 4-star movie. I'm not going to lie. I was like, wow, I can't believe that Chris didn't give this one 4 stars. And then about halfway through, I'm like, oh, I remember Chris said this was going to happen. Because, I mean, what made the first one great was as you're watching it, you get an idea. It's like a kid playing, and then you get that reveal at the end. Unfortunately, this one, like, overdoes that, and it takes you out of this wonderful story, and it's like it's hitting you over the head with these things. So it takes something that literally and it's not the first time today I'm going to talk about this. Literally, I was on the way to a 4-star, and it's like it ended up getting cut all the way down to 3 because it just didn't know how to handle itself properly, which was really disappointing because it had so much fun energy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I said in my initial review, great first half, and it's the second half where it starts falling apart. So we agree 100% on this one. I did really love the musical number.
Oh, there were so many wonderful, wonderful things that they didn't need to try to explain as to why it was real world applicable and stuff like that. And it just... We get it. It was more
preachy, more didactic, I think. Yeah. I don't know if that's quite the term, but they should have just went more with the imagination.
Yeah, we knew it was the brother and sister playing. We knew it, okay? We got that from the first movie. It's understandable. That's just, what are these characters doing? Anyways, still recommend.
Me too.
Could have been so much better. Happy Death Day to you. This one, you know, I didn't like as much as the first one, but it still gets a recommendation. This one still really, really leans in to the performance of Jessica Roth by playing Tree, the main character, and she's just wonderful. I really hope she gets more lead roles because she proves that not only can she do it, but she can be absolutely magnetic. And she can be just someone who you're just following through a tale. I like the fact, too, that this is different. It's sci-fi. And it doesn't have to, while it does the repeated, you know, day being repeated, it doesn't do the same way. So it proves it's got a reason to exist. And I liked it. And I do definitely recommend it with 3 stars.
And the unfortunate thing is, in my original review, I mentioned that there was a stinger worth watching. Uh-huh. And then you said, you're going to have to remind me of that. But then you didn't tell me you were watching this. So you saw it, told me a week later. And I said, well, did you get to see the stinger? You said, no. So that's the sad part of this movie.
That's the very sad part of this movie. So
you knew Oops. You would see it, but you forgot to let me know you're seeing it so I could remind you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I dropped it ball.
So far, I think we are 100% in agreement on these movies. Oh, no. Fighting with the Family.
Yeah. Did we talk about Captain Marvel the last time I did the roundup?
I think so.
Oh, yes. We're gonna
Let's skip that one.
Yeah. We're going to move on. Escape Room. I know we didn't talk about this one. If you want to talk about some of the criticisms that I had with In the Tall Grass, of it almost feeling direct to video at times and stuff like that, I found I had sort of the same feeling in Escape Room, especially some of the scenes where there were flashbacks for some of the characters. Really, really didn't necessarily feel the super tightest. However, you know what? The right movie is able to overcome anything. And this movie has fun characters, it's got a fun vibe, and it is passable. It's watchable. Not only is it passable, but I'd probably watch it again if it were to pop up on Netflix. This is a fun film. I like the casting. It's got its own energy. It's like I said to begin with, it's not necessarily the tightest or the most polished, but it doesn't need to be because it's not trying to shoot for the stars necessarily, I don't think. It's just being its own thing. And when you're your own thing and you do it well enough, you get the thumbs up. So 3 stars for Escape Room.
Yeah, and like I said, my initial review is Cube meets Saw. And I loved the set pieces in this film. And I think it's great gateway horror because it's not mean-spirited, even though these characters are in this evil situation, but it's more of a thrill ride. It's more of an amusement park ride. And I think for sort of those not children horrors, but sort of getting Everett to go into more adult horror, I think this will be a great introduction film.
Oh, it'd be great. It's not gory. It doesn't try to drag you down into the worst depths of morality or anything like that. It's just about being fighting. It's about flowing. It's about getting the heart pumping and just being entertaining. And it does that all very, very well.
And it's fun, which you can't always say about horror movies.
No, exactly. Which, I mean, we said about Happy Death Day, the first one. It was fun.
Yeah.
And Escape Room, I mean, that's a fun one as well. Now, John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. I said I was going to be saying once again that there was a movie that I was certain was on its way to getting a 4-star from me. John Wick Parabellum.
That introduction.
Okay. If I were to say, without even seeing all the movies of 2019, if you were to say, what are the, you know, tell me some of the movies that are going to be in the best, top 10 best fight scenes of 2019, I would say 4 of them come from John Wick. The library fight, the knife fight, the North Africa fight with the dogs and Halle Berry, and then the motorcycle fight. 4 perfectly crafted fights. You know, something always needs to be a bit better, a bit different to get us going back for something. And sometimes people think it needs to be bigger. Now the whole world's got to be in threat or something like that. They don't do that with John Wick. They just craft these really, really imaginative fight scenes that are absolutely stunning, not just in how they're set up, but how they're shot and how the camera moves. Now, some of these films, if you were to ask me, would any of them be in the top 10 for the decade? Yes. Would any of them be top 10 all time? Well, obviously that Halle Berry dogfight in North Africa, I couldn't see myself not saying that's one of the top, in the top 10 of fight scenes all time. It is.
I want to know how they did it.
It and the camera's moving the whole time. Like, how do you? I love when fight scenes when the camera moves, because you know you've got your people doing the stage combat, and usually it's from a set angle so that they can, you know, pull the punch a certain way so it looks realistic. However, when you're moving the camera and rotating it around, all that's got to constantly change because these aren't quick shots. They play out, and you've got now you've got animals involved, and some of these shots I'm like, I had to watch a few times. So I'm like, holy crap, it hasn't edited, the camera angle hasn't, like, it hasn't switched to a different camera. You have to watch this multiple times because your mind is blown about how they just conceived it mentally and how they were able to pull it off. Honestly, insane stuff. Now, that was about the hour and a half mark. And if the movie ended there, it would have been a 4-star movie for me. No questions asked. 4-star. This is the best John Wick ever made. Hands down. However, it then goes on and then it goes past, like, you know, when like a roller coaster shouldn't be 8 minutes long because eventually you're tired of the rush. It's got to be, there's a reason why they're shorter, because it's got to leave you amped and wanting to get on the next one. This one just went on too long. And the fight scenes, after those 4 amazing fight scenes, they just became something we've seen before. They were generic. We've seen it, and not that they weren't well done. It's just that you had something that was perfection. You should have stopped it because they didn't keep that up. So I just really, really wanted this to be over. I wanted it to finish, and it didn't. I give it 3 stars. If you're to rent it, stop it at an hour and a half. Walk away. You're done. Because it doesn't really add anything to it. You've got 4 beautifully inventive scenes. Leave it at that. Should have been, but I still recommend it. Sorry, that was a long, long one.
Yeah, I think we basically, once again, are in total agreement. if people remember my review where I thought there was amazing action sequences at the beginning. They blew me away. It was an incredible introduction. Some of the most memorable stuff. I loved going back into this world. I loved everything they did with that. I thought the Halle Berry character was fantastic. Loved what she was doing. And then as the movie went on, like you, near the end, the fights didn't stand out anymore. They were still good fights. Mm-hmm. They're just as well choreographed. But the problem was we already got too much of a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It should have been stopped. I was fine with the ending. I like that it once again leaves it open for another movie, but it doesn't feel like it feels like we could still stop at John Wick Chapter 3. But, oh, go ahead.
Oh, if people remember my review, I was bothered a little bit more, I think, with the ending than you. I thought this one was a little bit more cliffhangery than I would have liked. I seem to be the only person. Everything I read, no one else seemed to be as bothered with that. But that wasn't the issue. Like you, I gave it 3 stars because I just felt like, yeah, it could have been tighter.
It could have been, and if it was
such... And the final villain, just I didn't feel they built to that well enough based off the things that with the end. We're supposed to have this big climax, and it wasn't that exciting.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was too bad. I think there was still some all right world-building stuff in that last 40 minutes or so. It just...
Not as good as the two previous movies, I felt.
Yeah, yeah. So it could have been shortened. I see what you're saying about the end. It was more, I guess, it was more of a jumping off platform. But I also felt like I was satisfied with what I had just seen. So I get what you're saying.
No, you're right. And I mean, the final line, it's so John Wick, and it's still kick ass. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's 3 stars. And I feel like I like the other two a bit more, but I'm totally ready for John Wick 4.
Yeah, me too. Bring it on. Bring him on. I want to see more, which is crazy. One of the best action franchises of today. Just good stuff. Now, Pet Sematary.
Today, I would say one of the best action franchises, period.
Period. No, that's, yeah. You're absolutely right. And this
name another action franchise has made 3 movies and they're all recommended.
Well, I was about
Terminator can't even do that.
No, and because I was about to say it, some people might get mad, but it's better than Die Hard. Not that any of the movies have been better than the original, but as a franchise, I'd say it's even better than Die Hard.
Oh yeah, the original's better than any of the John Wicks. I love the original, but I think the other 3 John Wicks beat almost every Die Hard after that, except maybe 3. I really have a soft spot for 3.
Mm-hmm. Now, on to a Stephen King adapted film. Ooh, ooh. Remember all those criticisms I had of In the Tall Grass? Well, what I found super refreshing from Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer, the co-directors of this film, is they know what makes a Stephen King story work. And so... in this movie, it's about death and, you know, if you feel guilty for it, do you feel responsible for it? Do you...
You forgot to mention the movie.
Oh, Pet Sematary. Sorry. Pet Sematary. Thank you. Makes things a bit clearer now. I'm not talking about the dark half. what was I saying?
Sorry.
That's okay. It's okay. Yeah,
I just wanted the viewer or listener to know
what we're talking about. It's kind of important, yeah. And also just like accepting death and letting it be, because this movie, it shows that these characters, that's something that's with them the whole film. That's a constant with them. A lot of Stephen King adaptations, they might say, "Oh, look, this is an issue," but once it's confronted in the film with an action. Here we have it actually being an overriding theme from the start, which is what makes Stephen King books really, really good. Amy Smith, she's the wife and mother, and she's got a history with this about death and facing it and responsibility towards it. So I love that. I mean, this is not the most well-crafted movie, I would say. Some of the supernatural scenes, the supernatural foreplay really didn't work and felt jarring. Didn't need to be in there. This is an atmospheric movie. You don't need to get people, like the first while should be atmospheric. You don't need to, you know, freak people out. It's going to come. So I didn't think that any of that was needed. I love the casting. Jason Clarke as the husband, Amy Smets, as mentioned, as the mother, and wife, John Lithgow. Wow, he plays Judd really, really, really well. I love him in this. It's wonderful. And Jette Lawrence as Ellie. This was, if it was a bit more confident in what it was going to be, I think this would have been a better film. But I recommend it because when it does get creepy, there's a scene with if you, a spoiler, the daughter dies and then comes back because the father brings her back. That's, I mean, anyone who knows anything about Pet Sematary, I think knows that that's what it's about. Like, it's like saying that there's a kid in the TV in Poltergeist. It's just sort of what happens. But there's a scene with her and Jason Clarke laying in bed and she's got this lazy eye, after she's been brought back, and it's just so creepy. There's something so creepy about that scene, the camera just watching them lay side by side in bed. I love scenes like that, and that's what the director should have known. That's where their money was, instead of some of those other things that we're trying to, you know, force throughout the movie to make it feel proper spirit supernatural thriller the whole way through. It was getting there. It just, they needed to have confidence in that. Anyways, this is a long talk. 3 stars for Pet Sematary.
Yeah, so once again, we're basically on the exact same page. If people remember my review, I gave it 3 stars as well. All the same reasons. I thought it was atmospheric. I liked the performances. I agree with you 100%. It was just the foreplay and basically trying to force things a bit that put it down to 3. Because I think this is a movie where halfway through, I was going to give it 4 stars. I was way into it. And then they try to force a few things. My other frustration, but you already spoiled it here, but at the time, my one frustration was the trailer spoiled the switch, because if people have read the book, they know it's the boy who goes, and the movie does a good job of setting you up, think it's going to be the boy again, and they switch it. And that was my one frustration. The trailer actually ruined that.
Yes, and I should have remembered that, because when I was watching it, and when the switch happened, I was like, oh, didn't see that coming. Because it does set up the boy going, as you're right. And then I also have to say that dreaded scalpel and ankle scene, they knew that stood out in people's minds, because they teased that before it happened. I think they knew that people like me just couldn't get that out of their mind from the book or the previous movie.
No, it's in everyone, and every single time it gets me.
It's horrible. Oh. So yeah, this could have been bad. This could have been so much better, but it's still a recommendation.
Yeah, no, me too.
Now to the only movie actually that I have caught up on that I'm not recommending: Godzilla, King of the Monsters. This movie is so dang repetitive. Godzilla gets knocked down. Oh no. Oh look, a monster's just about to take us out. Oh, Godzilla showed up at exactly the right time. Oh no, he got knocked down. And guess what? Oh no, monster's about to kill us. Oh no, Godzilla came back and say, and that happens 3 times. You can't do the same thing 3 times. Is there no other way to make this movie engaging? Is there no other way to have monsters fighting than to have that formula? It was wrong to do that so many times, because that's how, I believe that's how the first movie ended, the 2014 one, is it had that, and it was fine, because I mean it wasn't stealing that after two other times in the movie. This, I didn't like the characters. It's a husband and wife and a daughter who is absolutely completely useless. Or wait, were they, see, they were broken up, weren't they? I don't know. I don't care.
Yes. Divorced. They're divorced.
Mm-hmm. But the daughter...
Or separated.
Separated, yeah. The daughter, she was... Her only reason for existing was motivation for her parents, which, I mean, sucks, because, you know, it means it's going to be very annoying because there's not anything realistic about it. Characters' turns and decisions, wow. Speak about not realistic. And for there being these secret monster sites that all over the world that start getting raided by people, they really don't step up security, and they let people with guns just walk up and say, what are you doing here? Ah, they're here to get the monster. Man, I did not like this movie at all, but I thought that special effects were good, and there were some semi-redeemable things in it. Mainly Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga. I didn't like their characters. I do like them as talents. Oh, and Sally Hawkins and Bradley Whitford are in here as well. So, I mean, there's... Oh, and O'Shea Jackson Jr. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but blinking, you miss him. His character's useless.
Yeah, yeah. And Ken Watanabe. But anyways, so the cast is good. But, I mean, this movie doesn't need to exist. And the worst thing about it is... they just don't know. They don't know what makes monsters fighting interesting because they use the same structure three times over. No, I'm not joking. Three times over, it does the exact same thing. Oh, I gave it a star and a half.
Yeah, this was really disappointing. I mean, it's really disappointing that I agree with you that the young girl's useless because it's played by Millie Bobby Brown, who we know is awesome as Nine in Stranger Things. So she should have been used better. I feel the cast, as good as it is, was completely misused in this movie. Nobody was super interesting in this film. The people who did like this movie was praising that they apparently think there was more Godzilla than the first one. And I guess maybe runtime possibly because this movie's longer, but he still takes three naps throughout the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean.
And when we do get the monster stuff, and like I said in my review, the build looks good. When you see them standing and going towards each other, like, oh, this is going to be awesome. But then it's framed and edited and cut really poorly that I didn't really know what happened to any of the fights.
Yeah, the fights themselves weren't that interesting. They were just the same things over, you know, just pushing, shoving, shoot a laser, shoot a fire. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because this was directed by a guy that I know a lot of people really like. He got on the map with Trick or Treat, a horror movie that I still actually haven't seen, but I know a lot of horror fans hold up. He did Krampus, which I didn't recommend, but I definitely saw an interesting hand in there. I like some of the stuff he did. So I think Michael Dougherty's got a future. Just didn't seem like the right movie for him.
No. And I think it made it quite obvious that I don't think this movie would have been right for anyone. I don't think there was... script.
Oh, it's an awful script.
Yeah, the script itself isn't there.
And I mean, I didn't recommend Kong Skull Island, but there's a lot that I liked about it. We both recommend the first one, but this is the movie that has made me probably really, unless the reviews are good or the buzz is huge, I don't think I'm going to bother reviewing Godzilla vs. Kong for this podcast, to be honest.
I don't blame you at all.
It's one of those things where if the word comes in, I feel like, oh, we need to talk about it. But I just feel like the Transformers movies, it's one of the big budget movies that's worth skipping.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot to mention something from Tall Girl that really seemed like adult writing for kids. Dunkler's, I believe it's him who says, it's like watching a UFC cage match.
Yeah, that made me laugh.
UFC
because
cage
whatever
match.
Happened, I was like, "That there's no way a teenager would have said that."
No, that's like watching a wrestling ring match.
Yeah, UFC cage match opposed to what?
What other type of fight match is this opposed to? Yes.
And if I remember the fight that was going on, if I remember properly, it looked nothing like a UFC cage match.
Not a cage match. That's right. Not a UFC cage match. yeah, definitely is one of those moments where you're like, wow, they really are trying to sound like a teen and don't know how.
They're always talking about their cage matches.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Any other movies on here?
That's it.
Are we all caught up?
We are all caught up.
Well, there you go. We're all caught up, folks. We'll do this again in a few months, I'm sure. You may have noticed that I haven't seen as many movies this year as I did previous years, various different reasons. And so there's potential the next catch-up, Scott will be reviewing a bunch of movies I haven't seen.
Oh, I could do that? Because I've seen a lot more 2019 movies, like Hole in the Ground and Little Big Ones, and there's been a few really good ones.
Yeah. Is there any quick ones that you want to just bring to the listeners' attention?
Ones
that are worth it?
Okay. Ones that are worth it. Hole in the Ground is a British horror film, which is really, really nice. It's atmospheric. It's got a build, and it's definitely worth watching. Little Big Ones, I believe it is. Little Big Lies was a show. Little Big Ones. Little. Okay, well, give me a second. I'm looking at my notes here.
I would help you if I could, but I don't know that movie.
Okay. Giant Little Ones. Giant Little Ones. This one.
Oh, I do know that one. Sorry.
This one has Josh Wiggins in it, who we had talked about most recently, or only ever, on the Underdogs podcast, because he was in Walking Out. This is a movie about homosexuality, but it's not someone coming out. It's someone who's accused of it. So it's looking at a teen's response to that that branding. Really, really quality film that's worth seeing. Another one would be, they said The Hole in the Ground. Little Woods. Oh, yeah. Little Woods is really worth seeing. This is a drama that has Tessa Thompson and Lily James in it as sisters, and it's a wonderful drama. It's got some crime elements, and when you've got Tessa Thompson and Lily James side by each, it's absolutely worth seeing. And then also I mentioned on the mid-year, I'll just say really quickly, Room for Rent. That is a Lin Shaye vehicle that Lin Shaye fans have to go out of their way to see. Don't just wait to see it. Go out of your way to see it. You won't be disappointed. Olivia Wilde in A Vigilante. Gotta see it. Arctic. Mads Mikkelsen. Gotta see it. And I think that's the main of them.
And if you are a listener who, at least in Canada, has the Canadian Amazon Prime, A Vigilante and Arctic are both on there.
And those are both worth seeing, because we saw Mads Mikkelsen earlier this year in Polar, and that wasn't a movie that used him properly. Arctic, it shows just how talented of an actor he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you. And now I'm going to run down the movies we talked about this week, on the beginning part of the show. The first one is In the Tall Grass, the adaptation of a Stephen King, Joe Hill combined novella. And I and Scott, I think we agree on almost everything here. We liked the atmosphere here. We liked the concept here. It was enough for Scott to recommend. I had a little bit of problem with some of the character motivation and some of the mythology. So I went 2.5. We both don't think horror fans will enjoy it. And then we continued the 2.5 as we agreed this time on Tall Girl. We both, I think, liked the coming of age movie, but we just couldn't recommend it because, again, I think there was too many characters, and there was a few things where the movie just seemed to be out to lunch on. For example, that we would love the best friend who stalks the main character. And then we moved on to Hello Privilege. It is me, Chelsea, and we both recommend it. We feel we would have liked it going deeper, but we think it's worth checking out. It's an interesting exploration on racism and, well, white privilege. And so we give that one 3 stars. So I guess it's the documentary that we are at least agree that everyone should see.
Yeah, yeah. And Chris nailed it when I about In the Tall Grass. He said it would be basically my lame duck 3, and that's exactly what it is. But Hello Privilege, it's me, Chelsea. That's the one to check out.
Yeah, and horror fans, we still think that they'll get something out of the first one there too. And coming of age fans, I mean, if you're the fan of the genre, I don't think any of these movies are horrible.
No, not at all. Yeah.
And then if you can give us your thoughts on the movies this week or things that you would love us to talk about in the future, you can do that by email at themoviebreakdown@gmail.com. You can also do it over on Twitter at Breakdown1. And I just ask, if you are on Twitter and you listen to us, please help us out and spread the word on us. And hopefully we can get more followers. Or if you're on Twitter and you're not following us, please follow us. That would really help us a lot. And also join our Facebook page. We got a few new likes on our Facebook page recently, so thank you for that. And that's facebook.com/themoviebreakdown. And that's not just for our ego. If you follow us on these things, it actually helps us grow and expand and get more people. And if we get more people, then we can start the Ringside with an Idiot podcast.
Ringside with an
Idiot. Or my point is we could expand. I would love to do a podcast network, but to do that, we need to have followers.
Mm-hmm. And we could also bring back the midweek, which was more movie news and responding to that.
The reality is if you want more stuff, we need to be able to have those followers so that we can then start financing things. Because it actually, believe it or not, it may not sound like it, but it takes time and effort to do this show.
Yeah, it's actually quite a time commitment each week. Yep.
You're like, really?
Really?
I know.
Yeah.
I'm shocked too.
Mm-hmm. Next.
As you can also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, and that would help us as well. And then you can read our stuff. You can support us in other ways. My blog is chrisspicer.blogspot.com. I know Scott really wants to get to the closing, but first, pimp your stuff.
Okay. Movieaday.blogspot.ca or com. And I still need to get my daddy daycare review up because I'm going to forget about it and end up having to watch it again. So I really got to get that going. And then on Instagram,
if you watch it again, I will tell Deka he liked it so much he saw it a second time.
All right. I don't want to do that again. That's already happened once. And then on Instagram, I'm movie worth 1,000 words. Now, coming up, this is the big one. El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie. I'm curious. I've made sure I've read nothing about it because I want to know nothing about it. I was a fan of the show. I don't know if I wasn't hardcore, but this is something that I want to see. And so I don't know what it's even about other than it's probably going to be better than El Camino Christmas. And then also it'll be Zombieland 2 Double Tap. That's next week, right?
Yeah, no, it's some big movies next week, a lot of big star movies. Zombieland 2 looks like it's got a bunch of new stars, like Rosario Dawson joining along with the old crew. I'm looking forward to that. Ruben Fleischer's follow-up, I hope it's a lot better than Venom.
Yeah, because you really enjoyed Venom. I still have to see it. I have to form my own opinion, but maybe I will.
My opinion's good enough. Just follow mine.
Just follow yours. All right, then. Well, just make sure you text me about El Camino so I don't have to watch it. I'll just follow your opinion.
Yeah, I'll next week I'll tell you what to believe.
All right, sounds good.
That'd make for an interesting show. You didn't see anything. You just go off what I told you.
Uh-huh, yeah. That would really make it a good podcast, wouldn't it? Oh, yes.
Thank you so much for listening to us this week. Please come back next week. I'm Christopher Spicer.
And I'm Scott Martin. Tati byes.
Bye, everybody. We're talking over each other.
Tati byes. Tati byes.
Bye.